When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. If you want to tell the world something or sell the world something, head on over to Squarespace because they're going to help you build the website of your dreams. Say you want to sell some custom merch. Well, you can set up your online store, whether you sell physical, digital, or service products. Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. So go to squarespace.com/stuff right now, and you will face a free trial. And when you get ready to launch, use our offer code STUFF, and then you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. How could you go wrong with Squarespace?
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. Jerry's here, kind of. I think she went to go open the door for a delivery person. Other than that, this is Stuff You Should Know.
Hey, let's hope it's not the land shark
Canagram.
From the 1970s Saturday Night Live fame.
That's good stuff, man.
Hey, you know what? We need to shout out a listener because this was a genuine listener suggestion. We get lots of suggestions and sometimes we take them.
yeah I have one in the pipeline right now. I'm just gonna let it be suspenseful until then. Whose idea was
I'm trying to think of which one it might be for you, because I know what's in your pipeline, buddy.
Okay. We already did the enemas one.
I could peek through that scary that scary hole. This is Jamie Booher.
Nice name.
And I didn't even let Jamie know, so hopefully Jamie hears this and it'll just be a big surprise.
Yeah.
I know there's a certain listener out there who is hoping this would be possums, but here's a little hint. If you suggest something too much, it becomes a game where we will never do it.
Well, you can ask the guy who continuously asked for the Hawaiian overthrow episode. It's one of those things.
We kind
of
did that, didn't we?
We did do it. And it's one of those things that you want really bad. And then when you get it, you regret ever having asked for it.
Yeah. Just too much buildup.
Right.
You just got to let things come as they come.
Exactly.
Chill out.
Mm-hmm.
Look in your pipeline.
I predict that
for guidance,
we normally would have gotten to possums by 2027 easily.
Never now. Never.
Right. Now we won't. But today we're talking about pearls, right?
Yeah, pearls. And big thanks to Jamie Booher, because this is one I'm surprised we hadn't done. It's very Stuff You Should Know-y. Mm-hmm. Just sort of sitting out there at the bottom of the ocean waiting for us to discover it like a pearl diver, which weirdly was not even in this article.
No, I thought it was weird too. I did a little research on it, so we'll hit that in a minute. But
yeah, same.
Yeah,
we'll pepper it in. I read that Steinbeck book.
What was it called? The Pearl Diver's Daughter.
The that was the original title, but okay. He just shortened it and he just said, "Let's just call it the Pearl."
Oh, okay. I didn't know that was a Steinbeck book. I knew about Grapes of Wrath, As I Lay Dying, mainly because that metal band.
Mm-hmm. Travels with Charlie, Mice and Men.
What's the Cannery Row one?
Cannery Row of Mice and Men.
Mice and Men, man. Have you ever seen that with
Which one?
The one with Gary Sinise and John Malkovich as Lenny?
No, I saw the previous version when I was a kid that I want to say it was the Quaid, the big boy Quaid.
Oh, he'd be perfect for that.
Randy. And I can't remember who Lenny was. I think I saw pieces of the Malkovich one.
Okay. I thought you meant Randy Quaid was Lenny. I can't imagine him as anybody else. Maybe Curly, but no, I think Curly's kind of like a Casey Simasco-esque smaller dude. You know what I mean?
Wait, who did I say? Did I get it wrong? Who did I say Randy Quaid was?
You said you couldn't remember who Lenny was. I don't remember the other guy's name, but Lenny's the one who
Squiggy.
Gets old yellered at the end.
Right.
I guess I should say spoiler alert, right?
Oh, sure. But if you don't know what that is, just he's Cousin Eddie. That's all you need to know.
So, Chuck, let's start talking about pearls at this point. What do you think?
I think let's do it. Pretty neat little gem.
Yeah, you can make a really good argument, and I've seen it made all over the internet, especially from pearl sellers' websites, that pearls are far and away the oldest gem people have ever used to adorn themselves with. I don't know if that's true, but it's possible, because you have to mine gold, you have to stumble upon it. With pearls, I could see people just, you know, diving for seafood and being like, what is this thing? And, oh, there's another one over here. And then all of a sudden you've got, you know, these gems that are coming out of the Persian Gulf and being a big deal.
Yeah, and, you know, it was already weird enough that people cracked an oyster open and said, maybe I should eat that disgusting-looking blob. I know that's kind of an age-old question. It's like, who ate their first oyster? But when they saw a little pearl in there, I mean, first of all, the interior of any – or not any, but of many mollusk shells can be beautifully iridescent and very attractive to the eye. So I could see why somebody might crack a mollusk open and just say, hey, this looks interesting. Wonder if that piece of meat tastes good.
Yeah, and it does, but especially in a nice buttery lemon white wine sauce.
I think we should do oysters just separately at some point.
Okay.
But I found a little pearl. Turns out it was a blister pearl, which means it was, we'll get to this, but it means it's attached to the shell. But I found a little blister pearl one time, and I can't remember if it was just dining in a restaurant or whether it was from a shell when we were like clamming or something. But I thought pearls only came from oysters, and that is not true. They can come from just about any mollusk.
Right, but you do make a good point. Any mollusk can make a pearl if you're very inclusive of what forms a pearl, because they're formed through the same process. It's the difference between a true pearl and a non-true pearl, if you're going to be a purist, is the substance that it's made from. And even more mind-boggling than that, they're made from the same substance. It's just a different structural arrangement of that same substance that produces a true pearl or a non-true pearl.
I think that was enough mystery. Let's get in.
Okay, so one of the things that we need to know about pearls, and one of the reasons why they've been, you know, for thousands of years, they were like the great signifier of wealth, is because they're exceedingly rare in nature, just kind of globally. You'll find a pearl in about 1 in 10,000 mollusks. That's not very many pearls hanging around out there. So you can imagine that when a really nice pearl was found, it was, you know, very much treasured. And every single pearl, no matter what kind of pearl it is, starts because the little mollusk that forms the pearl is irritated.
That's right. You've often heard, you know, a grain of sand can turn into a pearl. That is true. It can be a little chunk of the shell. Most times it's a little parasite, and it's almost like an allergic reaction takes place inside the mollusk, in that they mount a defense by coating this foreign thing that gets in their shell, because, you know, their shell is ideally sealed up pretty tight, and they like to keep it nice and clean. But they something gets in there, and they go, all right, something's in here, shouldn't be. I'm going to coat this thing with a substance. And we'll get to what that is in a second.
Oh.
And that substance basically just builds up, and eventually it makes a pearl. And it, you know, it can be a little blister pearl that's still attached, or, you know, ideally what you're going to get to is a perfectly spherical, lovely little thing that could someday end up on a piece of jewelry.
Yeah. Now, we should say, like, that 1 in 10,000 mollusks, like, if you get 10,000 mollusks together on the beach, you would find a pearl in one of them. It would be even rarer than that to find a perfectly spherical or even close to spherical pearl. Like, those are really, really rare in nature, right?
Sure.
But that stuff that makes that pearl, depending on what kind of mollusk it comes from, if it's a true pearl, the stuff that they build up to kind of isolate that grain of sand or that parasite or whatever is called nacre. And nacre is this combination of a kind of calcium carbonate called aragonite. And then another substance, kind of like an organic binder, called concleolin. And as different layers are put down, add a little bit of water, slowly but surely, like the layer kind of gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and a pearl mm-hmm. forms around that. Again, you have to remember this thing that we prize and value and think is one of the most beautiful things in the world is a pearl's, like you said, an allergic reaction to an irritant. That's what it's doing. It just so happens that we find them gorgeous and like to wear them on our foreheads.
Foreheads.
That's a good, sure. great place for a pearl.
How'd you pronounce that second word?
Nacre? Conchiolian.
Yeah, you're throwing that L in there.
Mm.
It's very easy to want to do.
Conchiolian.
I get the urge. Yeah, conchiolin. And nacre, by the way, is spelled N-A-C-R-E.
Great word.
For those of you who love it when I just randomly spell things. And nacre, you know, I talked about that beautiful iridescence. It's mother of pearl. That is nacre. So when you look at the inside of a mollusk, of mm-hmm. a shellfish that has that wonderful sort of rainbowy iridescent look, that is the nacre, and it's really super strong. And I believe it even, you know, it's part of the structural integrity of keeping the mollusk strong, right?
Right. Yeah. It's like that's what we would consider like what our bones are made out of. That's what the mollusk's, you know, hardness is made out of, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
At least the interior part. So then there's the other non-true pearls. They're called non-nacreous pearls because they're not made with nacre. They're made with a calcareous concretion, which again is made from calcium carbonate crystals, but it's a different arrangement of calcium carbonate called calcite. And calcite is more stable than aragonite, but it's more fragile, and it's just not the same thing as a pearl.
Yeah, these are the non-nacreous are sometimes pink or brown, and they generally come from the queen conch. We say conch, right? Or mm-hmm. do we say conch?
Conch.
That's what I always said, but I also heard people say conch one time, and I thought I was mispronouncing it.
No, they were dead wrong.
Okay. and this conch mollusk, the queen conch is in the Caribbean, or is it Caribbean? Because I heard someone say it once.
It's the Caribbean. Yeah, you have to say it like you're about to sing the Billy Ocean song.
Yeah, Queen.
Yeah, but you can't say Queen. Well, you have to just leave everybody hanging.
Well, you've never noticed in that song, he goes, Caribbean Queen, conch, in the background. I do want to recommend this story that we're not going to get into here, but Olivia, who helped us with this, was kind enough to tease us. With a story from 2021 about a Thai fisherman who found a mellow pearl, M-E-L-O, and that's one of the other kinds of non-nacreous mollusk pearls. And it was worth about 300 grand. These things are really, really rare. They're you can't make them in nature, so that's why they're rare. And we'll get to, or you can't make them, you know, by human hand,
right.
I should say.
Yeah.
So they're super rare, and they're very fragile. And as a result, they're really expensive. But there's a really good story about this Thai fisherman who found one worth a lot of money, and just go look it up on the internet and read about it. But it's pretty involved.
So like you said, the non-nacreous pearls are made by the mellow sea snail or the queen conch mollusk. But the true pearls are typically made by saltwater oysters or freshwater mussels. Like when you're thinking of a pearl, it probably came from a mussel, possibly from Ohio or Tennessee of all places.
Yeah, the Tennessee River.
That was crazy? One of the most mind-blowing things I've ever heard. Or if it's saltwater oysters, it might be on the northern coast of South America. It might be on the Gulf of California off the Baja in Mexico. Those are some really good spots for it, too. Or it could also be in places in Japan, as we'll see, too.
Yeah, and the Tennessee River and a couple of these other places are some of the only places where people still dive for pearls.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, as you'll see, most pearls that we see today are made by people. Well, people and mollusks.
Sure, like in conjunction.
Yeah. But, you know, we can talk just for a little bit about pearl diving. That was how they used to find pearls. And if you think, well, I get oysters, you know, I live near the ocean, and I get oysters just in my oyster trap a few feet down.
Sure.
Those are almost certainly not going to be making pearls. The pearl-bearing mollusks are generally very, very, very deep. And these divers, it was kind of I don't know if it was the reason people started free diving so deep,
mm-hmm.
but people who were really good at free diving so deep often became pearl divers. And, you know, free diving are the people that Eventually they would get a mask, but they would, you know, you just go down there with your lungs and swim super, super, super deep.
Yeah.
And that's what the Steinbeck novel is about.
So like I saw that a pearl diver might dive down to 120 feet, 150 feet.
That's deep.
Yeah, that's like 50 meters if you're paying attention. That is extremely deep. That's actually beyond like the recreational scuba divers' limits. Mm-hmm. I think that's like 90 or 100 feet. So these people are free diving that deep. And yeah, they're having to hold their breath for many, many minutes, but they're pretty good at it. And the reason why I think they have to dive so low, and the reason why you're not going to find a pearl in an oyster along the shoreline, is because the flow of water has to be below a certain speed, or else the nacre's just not going to form correctly or at all, from what I can tell.
So they got to be just sitting real still?
Yeah, exactly. For sure.
Should we take a break?
Sure. We'll take a break and we'll come back and talk a little history, because turns out people have liked pearls for a really long time.
Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball. And you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Hey, everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture, shall we? You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that might not be for you.
That's right, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle.
How? Good question. Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic.
But you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. So visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, friends, did you know that it's estimated that 85% of all customer service interactions are automated?
Yeah, it's true. And customers are the lifeblood of all business. So you probably don't want to put that responsibility in the hands of a robot. And that's why thousands of business owners call Ruby and hire them.
That's right. Ruby is the virtual receptionist company who screens, transfers, and takes messages 24/7, all while making your customers feel special.
Yep, you definitely don't want to hire a subpar front desk person. And with Ruby, they engage with your callers in a conversational way, just like your best employee would.
That's right. Finding someone who cares about your business as much as you do feels impossible at times, but the team at Ruby are experts in providing the best customer experience and turn every ring into a relationship.
Yep, this year can be your best year yet. Small, efficient changes can make a huge impact on your bottom line.
That's right, and Ruby answers all of your calls live from right here in the U.S. They'll take messages, answer questions, route calls, and much more. Visit ruby.com, or better yet, give them a call at 844-900-RUBY.
So, Chuck, we're back and we're talking pearl history. And from what I could tell, for about 4,000 years, the vast majority of pearls came from around the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, or the Gulf of Mannar by Sri Lanka. And that was just the way it was. If you had a pearl before about the 1920s or 30s, it was very likely that it came from one of those areas in about the Middle East or Southeast Asia.
Yeah, and they were, like you said, they were always prized. Obviously, if you look at a pearl, it's anytime something really that beautiful comes from nature that's that rare, it becomes a precious item. And from the very beginning, and I mean, you name it, in most ancient places where you could get pearls, they were written about. They were prized and worn by the nobility, maybe nobility, definitely kings and queens, maybe sometimes only kings and queens, and not even like lower nobility. They were that rare. But they also kind of hoarded them. Like there are stories of, you know, ancient queens having like hundreds and hundreds of pearls. It's not like they just had like, oh, we found one and the rest, you know, other people can wear.
Yeah, I think the oldest pearl necklace that was found is comes from about 2,400 years ago or 2,300 years ago in a place that was called Susa, which we now recognize as Iran. And it was in a princess's sarcophagus. And it was a pearl necklace of 216 pearls.
That's a lot of pearls.
It is a lot of pearls, especially considering, again, like just any normal pearl is found in one in 10,000 mollusks. And this princess had 216 pearls. So she would have been what you would call fabulously wealthy at the time.
Native American cultures prized the pearl as well. As you'll see, if you can find them in the Tennessee River, then you can... there are other places in the Midwest of the United States where you can find pearls still today. So they love them and use them. I think mother of pearl has always been used. The ancient Egyptians definitely used it as far as 4200 BCE.
Right.
Even though they got pearls much later.
Yeah, apparently it wasn't until they were conquered by the Persian Empire about the sixth century BCE. That they finally got pearls, which does not make sense to me, but, you know, them's the breaks, history.
This Cleopatra story is pretty interesting.
I think we talked about this in our Cleopatra episode. I'm pretty sure. It sounds awfully familiar.
It did. As the legend goes, she bet Mark Antony that she could present the most expensive dinner ever made. And he was like, all right, let's see what you got. I think there's a catch, and there was a catch. Because supposedly pearl earrings were crushed into powder and dissolved into wine. And she went, game on, M.A.
She famously went, wah, wah, and then downed her pearl shot of vinegar.
Yeah, and supposedly he said, no, thank you.
No, that's too opulent for moi.
Yeah, I don't know if that would be bad for you or probably just benign?
Well, it depends, because there's a lot of cultures over the years, as we'll see, that have basically prized pearls for all sorts of medicinal values along the way. Like everybody from the Hindus to the Taoists to ancient Sanskrit medical texts like the Chakra Samhita all basically said, hey, pearls are really good for everything from prolonging youth to curing weak eyes. It's an elixir to restore strength. Like, I think anytime there's something that is valuable as a thing of beauty, they also just assume that it has some sort of healthful properties as well. And pearls were definitely in that realm.
I'm curious if there's anything to any of that, if there's been like modern studies on pearl dust.
Well, I know they put pearl dust in some skin creams, too, and it supposedly adds a youthful glow to your skin, but that smacks to me of basically the same thing as Sanskrit medical texts saying it restores strength and youthfulness.
And you know that because you use it, right?
Maybe. It's still worth a try.
Once the Crusades got going in the medieval era, they started trading with Asia. all these pearls were coming to Europe. Mm-hmm. And again, and once they made their way to Europe, they were basically off limits. There were actually sumptuary laws that said you can't have them, common people. You can't have anything nice.
Yeah.
That's what all these laws are about.
Yeah, supposedly it was to really keep the class delineations in order, but also sure. supposedly to prevent the lower classes from engaging in wanton spending that they couldn't afford, you know, in a, like a form of vice, like luxury, basically. The thing is, though—
Now we have credit cards.
Right, right. It's the opposite of a sumptuary law. The thing is, apparently, Scotland has really nice pearls. And I saw in more than one place that the story goes that Caesar actually invaded Britain because he was after UK pearls at the time, although it wasn't the UK.
Oh, really?
You know what I'm saying.
We still get those emails all the time.
For sure. We could, like, if you put a gun to our head, we could come up with it. But just sometimes on the fly, it's hard to remember.
Well, and sometimes when we say English or England, we're talking about England.
I think the official, right, right. But yeah, exactly. But I think the official thing is the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. I think I can hear some people in Europe clapping right now.
Well, speaking of them, the colonizers, of course, once they started making their way around the world and plundering everything, they obviously took wherever there were pearls, they would take and harvest those pearls and send them back to Europe again, whether it was Panama or Mexico or places in South America, wherever they went and they had pearls, they were for the, ripe for the taking. And again, they went back to the court generally. Men wore pearl earrings, apparently, in Henry's court. Elizabeth had thousands and thousands of pearls that were, you know, hey, a pearl button looks much nicer than a real button or just a pearl adornment. And so let's just use those instead of regular buttons.
Yeah, one thing that I found mind-blowing was that that her gowns would have thousands of pearls sewn into them, and that when you clean the gown, you had to take all the pearls off and then clean it and then sew all the pearls back on too. Can you imagine?
You know what? I bet if you told that story back then and Elizabeth was in the room, she would say, really? They do that?
Right, probably. And by the way, off with your head.
Right, for telling me that story.
Right.
I don't like guilt.
Man, that was a great Elizabeth the First impression.
Thank you.
So onward and upward, Chuck, because in the late 19th century, in 1896 in particular, a guy named Gaston Vives became the first human being, as far as we know, to set up a genuine, large-scale commercial oyster farming operation with the express purpose of producing as many pearls as possible.
Pretty good idea in 1896.
It is, and because what's the word I'm looking for where something happens in, like, in ratio form?
Okay, I know where you're going.
How about this? Because pearls are so rare, mm-hmm. Vives said, I'm going to overcome this by just having gobs and gobs and gobs of oysters so that just I'll beat the odds. And in fact, he beat the odds big time because he was farming oysters and harvesting anywhere between 4 to 14 pearls per 100 oysters. So he was having a 4 to 14% yield of pearls. Pretty good, right?
Well, I mean, way better than what we said to begin with, which is 1 in 10,000.
Right, which is, so he was harvesting up to 14% of pearls, or harvesting pearls from 14% of his oysters. The worldwide estimate would be harvesting pearls from 0.0001% of oysters that you would find.
Yeah, and I don't think we said this was in Mexico. And, of course, these are reports that this happened, and 14% is the very highest end. Mm-hmm. It was 4 to 14, but that's, even, let's say it's 4%. That's still a lot more. And the only thing that people can reckon is that it was just a place where they had a lot more pearls, because that can happen.
Yeah, the conditions must have just been just perfect right there in the Gulf of Mexico. So good for Gaston Vives. But one really important thing to remember about Vives's operation is he was farming them naturally. Again, he was overcoming the odds just by sheer numbers of oysters he was raising. But he also figured out some really important stuff, too, that the better you take care of your oysters, the more you protect them from predators, the more you protect them from disease, the more you scrub them free of barnacles several times a year, the likelier they are to produce a really nice pearl. And so he established some techniques that I believe are still kind of foundational in pearl culturing today. But he did not try to artificially implant or get, I guess, jumpstart pearl creation in oysters. He was just letting it happen naturally. So he wasn't technically culturing pearls. He was just farming oysters for their pearls.
Yeah. Cultivating, right?
I'd say culturing.
No, I mean, he would have been cultivating.
Oh, sure, sure. Grooming, breeding, raising.
Uh-huh. Beating the odds.
Sure.
If you want to talk about making pearls, culturing pearls, of course, you got to look to ancient China. They're the first people that kind of started doing that. They put little molds. This is very cool. They put little molds that had different things, but chiefly little Buddha images into mussels, freshwater mussels, around 500 CE. And they would develop those blister pearls that I talked about that I found one time that are attached to the interior of the shell. And it would be in about the same shape. It's not like it produced a perfect little Buddha blister pearl, but looked enough like it to where it was, you know, a pretty ingenious thing. They were not, they were, you know, I think the blister pearls are called like half pearls or hemispherical. They're not obviously prized and the kind that you want to put on a necklace, but it kind of got the ball rolling as far as knowing that we can culture pearls.
Right. They would say, it either looks like Buddha or Abraham Lincoln, guaranteed. So a long time after that, people started like really trying to figure out how to intensively cultivate pearls or culture pearls. Now I'm confused, but there was a guy named William Saville Kent, who was English, believe it or not, and he was a marine biologist working in Australia. And he said, you know, I really think this Gaston Vives guy is onto something. But I think he's missing the point. He's just kind of letting nature take its course, beating the odds, you could say. And instead, Saville Kent wanted to kind of like hasten nature, to kind of like increase his chances even further by trying to figure out how to make pearls happen unnaturally, I guess. And he never got any further than creating blister pearls, which from what I can tell is the easiest pearl you could possibly make. And he died in 1908, and he just never cracked that code. But shortly after that, in another part of the world, in Japan, there were some guys who'd been working on this independently, and they did crack that code finally.
They did, and we should mention the reason that they wanted to speed up the pearlness of the world was not only just to obviously make more money if they could control something like that, but in Australia and in Japan, they were... these mollusks were overfished at the time, which meant obviously they were underpearled. And so they kind of had like there was a need created for pearls that wasn't being met. So all of a sudden they started saying, hey, we can if we can make a blister pearl, maybe we can carry this over and make regular real pearls.
Right.
And in Japan, there's the Okoya oyster. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say fast. And abalone, which is like a big, very expensive kind of seafood. It's a sea snail.
Oh, is it?
And,
It is?
Yeah, abalone.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
What do you think it was?
I thought it was more clam-like than snail-like. That was my guess.
Well, it's called a sea snail, but it looks like a clam.
Oh, okay. There you go.
It's one of those things. Sort of like a, oh, never mind. I'm not going to say that.
I want to know. You have to text it to me.
Oh, that's okay. Well, yeah, I'll text it to you.
Okay.
So these two things, the Okoya oyster and the abalone in Japan and the waters around Japan had very nice natural pearls being produced. Again, underpearled because of overfishing. And in 1888, there was an oyster farmer who figures very highly in the story name. And this gets a little confusing because a lot of the names are similar.
Really?
But his name was Kokichi Mikimoto. And he started working with a professor named Kachiki. Is that right?
Kakichi.
Kakichi. Mitsukuri, mm-hmm. And he was from Tokyo Imperial University. And they started working together, trying to get a technique going for initially growing these blistered pearls. And they were successful in that not only could they get that going, but they could actually industrialize it and make it like a really ramp up the process and get a lot of them going.
Yeah, Mikimoto's aim for starting to cultivate pearls was because he wanted to democratize pearls. He wanted anybody at the time to be able to wear a pearl necklace. And that's why he was, you know, he set about trying to figure this out. And again, like you said, the best they could come up with were blister pearls. And they call them half pearls for a reason, because you have to break them off of the shell, the inner shell. Yeah. And so you've ruined one side of it. Whereas a true pearl will form inside the oyster and can just be kind of plucked out rather easily, and it's a whole pearl that's not attached to the shell. So it seems like if you could make a blister pearl, you could make a true pearl, and it just was not that easy. And neither Mikimoto nor Mitsukuri ever figured it out, really. It was actually a student of Mitsukuri's, a guy named Tokichi Nishikawa, who actually came up with the way to create a genuine pearl through cultivation practices. And the same process is essentially used today.
Yeah, it's basically what they did was they said, hey, let's take what nature does. And that's like what we have to sit around and wait every 10,000 mollusks to see happen. And let's just do it ourselves. Let's figure out a way to speed it up and do it by hand. And they did. They would cut out that, you know, we talked about the nacre. Mm-hmm. They would cut out the part of the oyster, which is the mantle that secretes that nacre. Mm-hmm. They would artificially put in a little bit of shell instead of like a grain of sand. They would use, I think they found a little like round cutting of that iridescent shell works best, right?
I think they found that mussel shells work best for some reason. But yeah, they would make them round or spherical.
Right. And then they would put that it back into another oyster.
Right.
I think of the same variety. I don't think they mix and matched. And that would basically cause that process to start. They would say, something's in me that shouldn't be in me. And it would create a little pearl sac. Right. It has that little seed in the middle. And it started just coating it with that substance.
Yeah. And so they would surgically implant shell pieces and like a piece of mantle from another oyster, which is kind of Mengele-esque if you think about it. And they would use little tiny modified dental tools to create this surgery. And it was really hard to do because you can't open an oyster shell more than 2 to 3 centimeters, which is not much, or else it's either going to kill the oyster, or it's going to upset it so much that it's going to reject this implanted nucleus, the seed for the pearl. So it's really hard to do. And again, this is still the way that they do this. And it turns out, strangely, there was an entirely other guy named Tatsui Mise, who was a carpenter. And he was working on his own version of the exact same thing, apparently independently, at the same time in Japan. And he and Nishikawa went to go patent their methods, found that the other one had applied for a patent for the exact same thing and came to an agreement, which I think is really sweet, because had it been like Thomas Edison or somebody, there would have been like legal battles and murders of elephants and all that stuff. These guys just came to an agreement to call this process the Mise Nishikawa method.
Right. Some people say that we talked about Saville Kent, who died without having perfected the non-blistered process. Mm-hmm. Some accounts do say that both of these people, which is, you know, basically how they were working independently on the same process, got their process from notes from Saville Kent, but I don't think that's been like proven out. So who knows? It's just part of the lore.
Well, yeah,
at this point.
I mean, plus Saville Kent never cracked the blister pearl barrier.
Yeah. the old BBB.
Right. Yeah.
Or BPB? BPB.
The blister pearl barrier. Yeah. The BPB.
So Mikimoto, who just as a refresher, was that original oyster farmer in 1888, was a really good promoter, really good marketer, had a pretty good operation going. In fact, they still the company is still around today, and they still make pearl jewelry.
Sure.
But they would build these big pearl structures at displays, at expo shows, and he would go around and talk to like governments and say, hey, this jewelry is like, I know we're making them by hand, but it's still like a real pearl.
Right.
Like, look at these things.
Yeah.
And sort of had to overcome the these aren't true pearls argument.
Yeah, the Diamondique challenge.
Yeah.
But he did overcome it. The thing is they're just not as valuable, not because they're not real pearls. They are real pearls that are made from the same stuff and everything. It's just that humans have intervened and taken happenstance out of the process, right? The reason that they're not as expensive is because there's so many of them. You can produce them so much more easily. And so Mikimoto actually did what he set out to accomplish. He democratized pearls. And now you can get a strand of pearl, like a pearl necklace, for like $100 if you want. And they're beautiful, gorgeous pearls that if somebody came up and said, which one's the natural pearl and which one's the cultivated pearl, you would not be able to tell.
No, not at all. They were brought over to America at a really bad time, just before the Great Depression hit in 1928. But they hung around. And then after the Great Depression, people started buying pearls and pearl necklaces. And another thing that happened was they started making just straight up imitation pearls. Mm-hmm. And these look great too. And Jackie Kennedy's very famous pearl necklace was not real. It was a gift from her mother. Mm-hmm. They were artificial pearls. I think a lot of times the pearl necklaces that you see can be artificial. And they sell like hotcakes too.
Yeah, I looked it up. I could not find for certain what Jackie Kennedy's pearls were made of, but the closest I saw was a guess at glass, that they were made of glass, everybody.
Yeah, there's been apparently all kinds of things, glass, alabaster, and then they would put everything from egg white to fish scales to snail slime to create that. You know, pearl has a certain look. It's not just like a plastic one looks plastic.
Right.
For a reason, but a good artificial pearl has a little magic to it as well.
Yeah, opalescence.
Should we take a break?
I think so.
All right, we'll take our last break and we'll come back and finish up with what's going on today in the world of pearls. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests and tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play. Hey, friends, did you know that it's estimated that 85% of all customer service interactions are automated?
Yeah, it's true, and customers are the lifeblood of all business. So you probably don't want to put that responsibility in the hands of a robot. And that's why thousands of business owners call Ruby and hire them.
That's right. Ruby is the virtual receptionist company who screens, transfers, and takes messages 24/7, all while making your customers feel special.
Yep, you definitely don't want to hire a subpar front desk person. And with Ruby, they engage with your callers in a conversational way, just like your best employee would.
That's right. Finding someone who cares about your business as much as you do feels impossible at times, but the team at Ruby are experts in providing the best customer experience and turn every ring into a relationship.
Yep, this year can be your best year yet. Small, efficient changes can make a huge impact on your bottom line.
That's right, and Ruby answers all of your calls live from right here in the U.S. They'll take messages, answer questions, route calls, and much more. Visit ruby.com, or better yet, give them a call at 844-900-RUBY.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
You've been looking for me, yeah?
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
These are the tales that shaped the nation.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
Then I told them they were drinking cyanide.
Featuring the voices of Wes Studi.
At least 4,000 people died on the trail.
Martin Starr.
President Nixon called me the most dangerous man in America.
Scott Hayes.
Next thing I know, I'm standing over the bodies of Baker Morton, my pistol smoking in my hand.
And Tristan Mack Wilds.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Starring Dan Fogler as the ferryman.
This is The Passage.
Listen to The Passage now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
All right, we're in modern times now, and things are still about the same. About 90% of the pearls, like genuine pearls that you're going to get, are cultured. It is, if you say I want a pearl necklace and I want it to be only pearls found from, that are natural pearls, then you got a lot of money laying around and you're pretty picky.
Yeah. but you can thank Mikimoto for not having to have a lot of money laying around or to be particularly picky. And there's a bunch of types of, cultured pearls. There's Akoya, South Sea, Tahitian, and Freshwater. And depending on the type of mollusk that's used, it's going to produce different colored gems, basically. Because I don't know if we said or not, a pearl is considered a gem, even though it's not like a mineral in the sense that like a diamond is. But it still has a crystalline structure, so I guess it's considered a gem. Plus, people just like to wear them on their foreheads, as I said. But if you want a black pearl, you're going to have to go down to Tahiti and get one from the black lip oyster, which is just all around cool. Yeah, they are cool. And they're not necessarily all black. They can be gray. They can be brown. They can be black. But they'll also have like kind of iridescent hints of like greens or purples, even pink I saw.
Oh, pink pearls?
Well, pink black pearls, which is mind-blowing, yeah.
If you're talking about just sort of the standard traditional classic pearl, they are produced in Japan and China, and those are those original cultured Akoya pearls still mm-hmm. to this day. Mm-hmm. And then I guess, you know, the freshwater pearls, those are the ones that come from the Tennessee River, among other places. Freshwater mussels produce them. They are not as expensive. They come in all kinds of shapes and sizes, mm-hmm. From lakes and ponds and I guess rivers, if it's the Tennessee River.
Sure.
And there are also little things called like rice pearls that look like what you would think, look like little grains of rice. They tried to perfect the process of getting them less rice-like over the years and found that if they just switched the species of mussel, then they could do that, and it worked.
Yes, and here's a little tip for you. If you want to impress everyone at the country club you obviously belong to, next time you see somebody wearing pearls that are not spherical, tell them you love their Baroque pearls, because a Baroque pearl is anything but a round-shaped pearl.
Yeah, if you look up Baroque pearl necklace, it looks almost like a necklace of molars.
Yeah, weirdly they do, and that's a... That's a natural looking pearl. Again, a perfectly spherical, even close to perfectly spherical pearl is really rare in nature. Mm-hmm. And so more often than not, you're going to see everything from like blobby, misshapen ones that, like you said, look like molars, ones that are like teardrop shaped. There's a bunch of different cool shapes that you know, can be produced as natural pearls. And all of those are Baroque.
Right. It is still kind of a rare thing to cultivate successfully or to culture successfully a pearl. They've gotten the process down pretty good, but it takes about 10 to 18 months, and about half of the oysters even survive that nucleation process like you were talking about.
Yeah.
Because it's really just very, very precise and is very finicky. And of those half, only about 5% will end up producing a high quality pearl. So when you're pearl culturing, I was about to say farming, I guess it's farming in a way, you are making most of your profit, about 90%, from that 5% of the 50%
right,
that end up becoming high quality pearls. And you can still do some stuff with a non-high quality, but you're not going to get the big top dollar prices.
And again, that's just from cultured pearls. Again, it just kind of reminds you how really rare the really nice natural ones are. And you said that it takes 10 to 18 months. I saw in some cases they'll give the pearl up to 4 years to develop. And while they're cultivating or culturing the oysters, the pearls in the oysters, they will scrub the oysters 3 times a year, protect them from predators and disease. These are like the most well cared for oysters, which is great. But again, they've had some other foreign object surgically implanted in them. And then when the pearl is taken out, I don't believe the oyster typically survives that process, which, if you really stop and think about it, is pretty mean. It's actually a really mean, torturous process. They're cared for while they're being raised, it's true, but they're killed to get the pearl out of them. They're just basically a machine to produce a pearl, is how the pearl industry views oysters or other mollusks that produce pearls for it.
Well, hopefully they become dinner and then part of someone's driveway.
They definitely do not necessarily.
They don't eat them?
No, and one of the... I think what Gaston Vivez actually might have come up with this technique, if it's not older, but I think it's still in use in places. They'll harvest the oysters when it's pearl harvesting time, and just to make the process easier, they'll dump the oysters into huge piles, cover the piles so that things can't get to them, like predators or like vultures or whatever, and let the oysters rot. And then the pearls are just easier to retrieve after the fleshy part of the oyster is gone.
Surely some of those dudes are eating oysters.
Some of them are. And how about this, Chuck? I've got a little fact for you that's going to keep you off of oysters forever. You don't, if you're eating a raw oyster, you're not eating a dead oyster.
I know. Everyone knows that.
Really? I didn't realize that.
Really?
Yeah, no, I'd never really thought about it, but they're probably dead, but if they're dead, they're freshly dead, and they're so freshly dead, it's possible that they're not actually dead yet, so you might be eating them live when you eat them raw. I hadn't thought about that. It makes me sad.
Yeah, I think you've shucked oysters before.
I have
not. You know that process. Really?
No, I have my oysters shucked for me.
Well, part of the shucking process involves cutting it loose from its shell. Uh-huh. Where it's attached, and I think that's that lifeline.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, it's a renewable resource, but PETA obviously is going to say, nah, making pearls is not something people do just because you're messing with an animal to get something from it.
Yeah.
So PETA's, of course, going to be against it.
Sure. And there is like a moral question about it. It is morally questionable, but there are some real upsides to it. One is it gives another industry to areas that might be subject to overfishing, so that they don't have to overfish just to make money. They can raise oysters as well for pearls. The oysters definitely clean the water in the area, that they filter out all sorts of impurities and problems. So it actually does make the water cleaner. And as long as they're not messing with like the coral reefs or the local ecosystems to create these farms, they're doing it in a more sustainable manner. It actually is a fairly sustainable industry. It's just, again, mean to the oysters or other mollusks.
Are you off oysters now?
I don't know. You'll have to ask me when somebody presents me with a platter of them and some crackers and mignonette.
Mignonette, you got to order that stuff. You just randomly get presented with platters of oysters? What kind of life are you living?
At the country club when I wear my string of molar pearls.
Should we go over kind of quickly a couple of these expensive, famous pearls?
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, if you want to talk about super expensive, super huge pearls, there are a handful that... you know, sometimes they look like super large molar. Sometimes they look like, Livia described one as looking like a giant white brain.
Mm-hmm.
They're not very good looking, yet they can be really expensive just as prized collectibles, I think.
Right.
It's not like, I don't think they've discovered a process where they can take a big, large brain looking oyster and break it down into, or a pearl and break it down into like 5,000 perfect little pearls, right?
No, not that I know of. No, it's more just like they prize it for its weirdness and rarity.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a, well, I think the biggest one we could find is the 75-pound pearl of Puerto. And the thing is whenever one of these comes out, everybody's like, that's so expensive. It's so valuable. That one was valued at $100 million. And it was found by a fisherman who kept it under his bed for a decade in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden he's sitting on a $100 million pearl. Or I should say sleeping over one, but it's never been sold. So no one knows if it actually is worth that. It's worth whatever somebody will pay for it, basically.
Exactly. It's a very good point.
But there is one called La Peregrina, and it is arguably the most famous pearl in the world. It's an egg-shaped pearl. It's been fashioned into different necklaces and different jewelry. It's appeared in portraits of queens, including, I believe, Elizabeth I, and then a bunch of Spanish queens over the years because it was part of the Spanish crown jewels. And then it finally made its way into a necklace that Richard Burton bought for Elizabeth Taylor in 1969, very famously. So isn't that neat? Imagine wearing a piece of jewelry that you knew was in a portrait of a queen that was made several hundred years ago. And now you're wearing it too. Like, that's just cool. That's one thing I like about stuff like this, or like a pearl, is something that can, you know, make its way through time and history from person to person.
Yeah. And part of Hollywood history. I mean, one of the great, often on romances in Hollywood history, mm-hmm. Some people would prize it just for that, from Richard Burton to Elizabeth Taylor's neck. And I think we should also mention, at least, that people are like, come on, I don't care about giant molars and brain-looking things.
Right.
Guys, what is the biggest, like, pearl?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the biggest really round, natural-looking pearl. And I think the biggest one they found is about, and it's pretty big if you think about a near-spherical pearl.
Sure.
About 0.7 inches.
Right. And
that's big.
It's 33 carats. If you know anything about diamonds, imagine a 33 carat diamond, but a pearl instead. And I think it sold for $1 million in 2014, appropriately enough.
A million buckaroos.
Yeah, you got anything else?
I got nothing else.
All right. Well, Chuck's got nothing else. I've got nothing else. And since I just said that out loud, that means it's time for listener mail.
And I'm going to call this, which is usually your trumpet howl.
Oh, would you like me to do it?
Yeah, please. Oh, you went an octave higher.
Yeah.
Very impressive. The Stuff You Should Know 5K is all set and ready for another year.
Yeah.
If you're listening, you don't know what this is. The Stuff You Should Know Army on the Facebook page, they get together, they plan out a 5K race / walk. And it's just a very fun community event that happens all over the world, I think. It's not like they all meet together in Kansas at Aaron Cooper's house
right.
and run from his driveway to the nearest grocery store, which is at least 5K. they do this at the same time in the spirit of all being together. And the dates are October 21st to October 31st.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a rolling race. They took a vote online, and the title of the race this year is the 2022 SY 5K is ready. Are you? In commemoration of the 10-year anniversary of the Camry ad that ran. It's probably still running for all I know.
It definitely is on some episode somewhere.
There is an event page if you want to find out more. They're getting all the details worked out still, but I wanted to drop this early. Just go to the Stuff You Should Know Army Facebook page. Do a little search for the 5K. They probably have something pinned. There is a listener named Sarah Denny Whatmore,
mm-hmm.
who has suggested a costume element if people are into that. and they're working out the prizes and things, and it's all going. So if you're into community and exercise and being a part of something cool, go check it out. And this, of course, was an update from Aaron Mizell. I don't know which way I've said it in the past, but
I'm saying Mizell.
Mizell, it's probably just Mizell. Aaron's great. She's been around forever. She was a movie crusher too, and that was still a thing.
Yeah, and she's a longtime member of the Stuff You Should Know Army, and maybe even the chair of the Stuff You Should Know 5K. I'm not sure. She's definitely up there. And if you want to be like Aaron and let us know something awesome happening, we want to hear about it. You can send it to us in an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Childproofing people's homes is hard, but Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/powersafely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.